This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 348 for Thursday, February 6th, 2020. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. Joining me this week is Mr. Alistair McFly. You can find him at iMcFly on Twitter and Alistair McFly on Twitch, where you're streaming from the Citadel these days, I think.
I am now, yes.
I'm recruiting. I'm bringing everybody in. Megan's streaming. Alistair's streaming.
Hannah's planning on streaming as
well.
So, the Citadel is becoming quite the Twitch place now. So, which is great because of how big the place is to be able to have so many different points of view people to watch is brilliant.
Yeah, that's true. I'm glad, and I've watched a couple of your streams, and I think I've sent my viewers over to you occasionally, and it's been fun. It's been fun to see things happening from a different angle, you know, like from your perspective and like what you're up to and what you're thinking while you're building things and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I believe I was there for Megan's first stream from the Citadel, but she was mostly just walking around and needed kind of like a, not a guide, but she, you know, was asking about certain things and which directions to go and stuff. So, but she wasn't building anything. She wasn't really interacting with the server. She was just kind of like getting herself refamiliarized, I think. So.
But it was fun having like being able to have her see everything that's changed after so long of being away from the server, because it kind of made me, you know, because I'm sort of in this position of, oh yeah, all that stuff has changed. That wasn't there.
Yeah,
you try to cast your mind back to like we have built quite a lot over this time.
No, it's funny. Like when you start, you know, when I started streaming every weekend, and then you start realizing that those are 2 to 3 hour play sessions twice, sometimes three times a weekend. Like that's 9 hours of, you know, progress that you're going to be making. Even if it's only a little bit at a time, it all adds up, right? If you keep consistent with it. And I don't anymore so much, but I used to play a fair bit on my own just for fun. I've got busy with work and I don't often have that kind of time in the evenings anymore. But for a long time, some of the stuff that I was doing was just like, I would just get on there and do things because I wanted to change stuff. You know, I wanted to move forward. And sometimes you can probably attest to this now as well. There are some things in Minecraft that are easier to do when you're not streaming.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Like there's just and planning and like and some creative decisions for whatever reason are best made in a bubble.
Yeah. And I think there's been a couple of times where it's like, there's this that I need to do. I'm going to do this off stream because it's going to be so monotonous and time consuming that nobody wants to watch 3 hours of you trading with villagers.
Well, yes. You know? Exactly.
So there's that. But I do find that for the time that I am streaming, I am so much more productive. If it's just me, I can just be staring, looking at something for ages going, but as soon as, you know, I end up sounding like one of the villagers as well. but when you have an audience, it forces you to make decisions and to actually push forward, and it helps with that motivation. And I have been so much more productive and probably come up with a lot better ideas than had I just been on there on my own without streaming.
Yeah, it's a nice, it's nice sometimes when you want the hive mind, you know, when they're courteous and you request help and you can get it. And then also, like you said, it keeps you from being too precious about stuff. And I find the same thing, like when I'm doing artwork on my stream, which I do from time to time, there's a little bit of a pressure, a little bit of like a dance monkey dance sort of situation going on sometimes, but it also helps me make decisions and move forward where I could potentially spend too long on something that doesn't matter, whether that's a piece of client work, whether it's a build in Minecraft, or it's like, Joel, like people are going to be, if they're walking by this and not flying by this at, you know, 100 miles an hour, they're not going to notice either way. You are the only person that knows that this is going to be here. So just make it look good enough and then keep going. One of my favorite, I'm not sure what you, he's an illustrator and he's a cartoonist and he's a teacher, but he, I guess we'll call him like an artist personality online, Jake Parker. And he very readily will repeat the perfect is the enemy of done. It's one of his favorite quotes. because he does like graphic novels and he solo, like he writes them, draws them, color, like he has a colorist, I think, that helps him now. But like these are solo things that he's doing. If you mull over every last detail and make every last frame in that graphic novel look immaculate, you're just never going to finish it. It's much better to have a 150-page graphic novel that shows your progress as an artist and that you can make the next one better than to be on the same graphic novel for 10 years, basically is the story that he talks about. And I agree, and I need to get better at that with Minecraft because it's nothing precious. It's a game. It should be fun. You know, it should move on. I did a stream last night, since we're talking about streams and nerdy stuff, and I know that our listeners are not all Minecraft players, but if you are wondering why your friends that are Minecraft players are going absolutely bananas, is because the snapshot for the Nether update was released yesterday, just an hour after Johnny and I finished recording the Spawn Chunks. So I did a stream last night where I hopped on a backup of the Citadel and I explored the Nether and looked around at some of the new stuff that's coming. And you'll get my full 2 cents on that on the next episode of the Spawn Chunks, which is going to be out on Monday. However, I will tease you and say that in some ways it was fantastic, and in a few other ways I was pretty underwhelmed. Did you see any of this? Do you watch any snapshot videos? Did you see any of the new content?
I saw Exumavoid's breakdown, because it's normally just everything in 20 minutes, which is always good.
Yeah, I watched CupFans, which is essentially the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the majority of what I've had, and along with Cosmic Dancer sending me a screenshot of her in all the new armor, and she was very excited about that because it does look good.
Yeah, very cool.
So I've kind of got the gist of a lot of the things that's going on, especially like when you're changing between biomes, how it just suddenly switches within a second.
So that,
which I believe, is a bug.
It is a bug. Yeah. So one of the people that I always watch when the new snapshot comes out is Sly Slime, who is a Mojang developer. So he knows what's up. And in several of the things that he mentioned, including the Hoglins, the Piglin Beast, I can't remember which they decided to call them. The Nether fog switching quickly, and there was a couple of other things. Fungi, the little crimson fungi, and the warped fungi, the little mushrooms that cannot be placed on grass. That's a bug. You will be able to place them in other places, probably similar to mushrooms, but they won't be able to be bone mealed into full grown trees unless they're on the Nihilium block, which is the new Nether stuff. Again, we're probably speaking Greek to a lot of the people that don't play Minecraft, but basically there's a lot of new blocks, a lot of new features, a lot of new recipes and things. Well, I say that there's not that. This is where I was disappointed. There's not a lot of new blocks, but it's all the same old, same old. Like there's not a whole lot that's coming out that's new. Like you get new wood types, but like you just get stairs and slabs and fence posts, and it's just really brightly colored, and it just seems like an odd choice. So
yeah, and the Nether is basically just like a massive hellscape, which has just looked the exact same for like the entire time it's been there. This time there's so much variety of sort of different areas, different forests and things like that, which is why people are excited. But this is a beta. This is what the snapshots are. It's the very first test version. So it's incomplete. There's bugs everywhere. It's for people just to try it out and give feedback so they can make it better, because it's still a long time away from actually being released. For real.
Yeah.
But and I'm hoping people just like have something new.
Yeah, I hope they come through with some additional changes to it. But one thing that I to end on a really positive note, what I did really like was walking around in the Nether used to be getting lost in a very boring landscape. And now you get really lost in a really interesting landscape, which I think it's really cool. Like, I mean, the crimson forests and stuff, they are dense. Like you will get turned around fast. And there's danger, like there's danger, there's cliffs, there's all this kind of stuff, but it's really cool to look at. You get lost because you just kind of want to see what's around the corner, right? So which I think it's that the biome stuff is a really positive change. But anyway, we can move on to some email we got from our listeners last week. This has been like an email heavy 2020. It's like a new leaf here on the Sizzle Cafe. And this one actually comes again from Lord Valor. Hello, Joel and co-host. I know you read my email last week, but I was just about to send another one right before you responded to my first. So here are my thoughts and questions on The Mandalorian. I agree with lots of the points you made with on your episode with Johnny. And I'm going to give a heads up to some people here. Mandalorian spoilers ahead. So if you have not yet watched The Mandalorian, we can't talk about this email without spoiling a few things. So tune out for the next 5 minutes or so. I agree with lots of the points that you made on your episode with Johnny. It was a very well-rounded show and kept me interested for the entirety. My first thoughts were that the fighting was quite slow. Then I realized that I had just gotten done watching Marvel movies, which are very fast-paced, fighting because they have superpowers. My only complaint, along with the ones you guys pointed out, has to do with the Mandalorian taking off his helmet. I would have preferred this to happen in later seasons, but I will admit that the scene fits with the story. I have a couple of questions regarding the future of the show. Would you like to know more backstory of Baby Yoda, or would you rather this be left to a person's imagination? Would you like to know where Baby Yoda grew up, if he stayed with the Mandalorian, or if he grew up on some other planet? My final question is, how long do you want to see the series go? Do you want it to go beyond two seasons, or would that be too much? If the Mandalorian ends up finding a place for Baby Yoda, would you like to see it continue without, even without the child? I love the show. I look forward to your podcast every week so I can fill my ear holes with nerdy information. Keep up the good work, Lord Valor. Thanks again for the email, Lord Valor. I'm glad we caught you mid-writing us when we were replying to you first, so you know that it was all not all for nothing. I don't think Baby Yoda is going anywhere. I think Baby Yoda is going to be with the Mandalorian for the duration of the series, whether that's two seasons, three seasons, whatever. We do know that a second season is coming in October to Disney Plus, so that's awesome. I mean, not that we were surprised by that news. But I think we are going to get more of Baby Yoda. And I think that the information regarding Baby Yoda's background is going to be a slow trickle. I think the entire series is going to be to get Baby Yoda to where Baby Yoda is either safe or as per the mandate given to the Mandalorian by, I can't remember the name of the character. She's the blacksmith. She's the armorer, I think is what they call her in the show. She gives him the mandate to find Baby Yoda's people. Right? Like that's his mission now. I think the rest of the series is going to be that mission.
Yeah. If they weren't, then that would have been wrapped up by the end of season one.
Basically. Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Where it's very clear that the child is here to stay for at least season two. But if they're spreading it into season two, there's no reason why the child is not like a core part of the entire direction of the show.
Yes. And there would be, and honestly, I mean, they would be silly not to. I mean, the show... the minute that Baby Yoda is not in the show, half the viewers are going to turn out. They're just going to be like
even if he wasn't planned, it's like they've kind of sealed him in now with the audience response to it.
I don't know if we're ever going to get the full story behind Baby Yoda. I think they're going to hint at it pretty strongly, but I don't think they're going to spell it out for us. Mainly because the characters in the show, they'll talk about events like the death of the Emperor or even seeing Baby Yoda use the Force, and the only person, Queel was the only person that even heard murmurs of what the heck was going on. And so the fact that these characters don't know that the Force even exists means that they are far enough removed from even the adventures of Luke Skywalker, who's alive at this time frame, right? And they don't know about that. So, you know, they wouldn't know about Yoda, the original Yoda.
It's one person in the entire galaxy.
Yeah, exactly. Now, granted, a famous person, but someone long believed to be dead, exiled, disappeared, missing, all that kind of stuff. It's hard because everybody as viewers knows all of these details because you as a viewer over the course of the Star Wars saga have seen all these, like these intimate relationships between Luke and Yoda, between Obi-Wan and Luke, you know, between even between Vader and Obi-Wan before he became Vader. Like, so there's all these things that you know, but no one else knows. No one else knows that. You know, I mean, half the universe thinks that, or more than half the universe thinks that Darth Vader killed Anakin Skywalker, right? So it's that kind of a misdirection, I think, that you have to remind yourself in these backwater planets. Then it's mostly rumors and speculation and stuff like that. So if we get more than two seasons, I hope they stick it on three. I don't want them to drag this out to the point where it gets terrible. Not that I think that they would necessarily let that happen, but that tends to happen when these things drag on. You know, when the producers start to see dollar signs instead of just following story, then I feel like, you know, it could potentially ruin something fantastic. So I'm hoping for three seasons. Yep. You know,
I mean, I'm kind of in the mindset of, I mean, three sounds about right, but given who's writing the show,
true,
given what we know about him, and just the feeling that we got from the entire of season one and how it ends with the child on board the ship, and I've forgotten the bad guy's name, but you know, cutting his way out of the TIE fighter with a darksaber.
Moff Gideon, yeah.
You know, yeah, it's obvious that they have an entire direction for this planned. I wouldn't be surprised if they've got, like, the entire series planned out. Yeah. I don't think it's going to be a kind of like, we're working this out as we go. I think it's going to be, you know, we are... you know, this is season one, this is season two, this is season three, and this is how the whole show ends. I think they've already sort of figured out that, and it's just the details from this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I would imagine they probably have a decent roadmap, and they probably had that going into season one, or at least a pretty good idea. And if it was a hit, then they knew that they could just roll forward with things. Because I mean, ultimately, I don't think that you get season two so quickly without them planning for season two already, right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
Next email comes in from Dale. I was listening to the Rise of Skywalker podcast yesterday when it came to an end of the movie. I felt the same way. Good movie, but it left me feeling kind of eh. The writing could have been substantially better. There were so many holes that it was left feeling almost empty. I watched it a second time to see if I could change my mind. I feel like the end of The Rise of Skywalker should have revealed to Rey the entire line of Skywalker, not just Luke and Leia. I think that this would have made it a lot more sense as a whole. I would have also given more credence to Rey taking on the Skywalker name. Makes sense? Question mark. I see what you're saying, and I don't recall this happening in The Last Jedi. Granted, I've only seen that movie twice, and the second time begrudgingly. I don't remember Rey ever getting the news that Vader was Skywalker's father, and that thus being Ben or Kylo Ren's grandfather. I don't remember her having that realization moment. It felt like that could be like a campfire chat, you know, with Luke, you know. I know that Vader's mask is in Kylo Ren's space. You know, like he has it with him, whether it's in his quarters or some other, you know, Sith, whatchamacallit, like a museum or a, you know, room that he keeps all these artifacts.
Like a trophy room or something like that. Yeah.
So she could, but there's not, I mean, unless she's inferring that knowledge, then there's no, we don't get to see her reaction. You know, you don't get to see Ben say he was my grandfather, and Rey being like, oh geez, that sucks. You know, like you don't get that kind of thing. So you don't realize when she takes on the Skywalker name if she's understanding the entire history, or if she's just saying, yeah, no, Luke and Leia were nice people, I'll take their name, right?
I mean, the direction that I come from is that she wasn't that surprised about Palpatine being part of her lineage. And he's an even bigger bad than Darth Vader ever was. But there's always been this kind of thread throughout Star Wars where people can sense all this stuff. You know, it's even as far as Darth Vader saying, search your feelings, you know it to be true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so people who are Force sensitive seem to be able to even sense things like that. So it may even be that with the connection that she's had with Ben and with Leia, she may even have been able to kind of sense that anyway. But at the same time, for her, it's about having a family name, because she's not had one. She's grown up not having that sense of family and belonging. And the Skywalker name is more just a, you know, we want you to feel like you belong. And I think that that is far more important to her than, oh, but their parents, their father was this big bad guy in the universe. Because for her, she's got a grandfather who's the worst in the universe. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't think it's that important for her. What she's holding on to more is just that feeling of belonging, and, you know, and the fact that, you know, the Luke and Leia, you know, that she had that kind of connection with them.
Mm. I'm still of half a mind that I would have preferred Rey to just own her lineage and be, say, you know, and said Rey Palpatine, you know, at the end, rather than hiding her lineage. A good example is that Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru, I think their last name is Lars, I want to say.
Yes.
They didn't hide Skywalker's name. They could have called him Luke Lars, right? If you want to you want to hide Skywalker from anybody looking for a Skywalker, don't call him Skywalker.
You know? I know. That's the thing that's always kind of got me. It's kind of like he's in hiding.
Yeah.
You know, like Leia, she's got a whole different last name.
Yeah.
But Luke, no, we'll just call him Skywalker. Like, as though Anakin's not going to come finding him, you know, Darth Vader. So, yeah, so, you know, it's like,
So I kind of liked the flip, because the whole story about Anakin is a redemption story, right? I mean, eventually Vader turns on Palpatine, throws him down the belly of the Death Star where he should have died permanently, and then ultimately comes back to the light side, bringing balance to the Force, and or showing that there can be balance to the Force. And I think that that would be a really cool flip, is that if you give Rey the Palpatine name, which not a decision I was keen with, but if you're going to go down that line, then have her own it and have the next saga, have the Palpatine saga be that now Palpatine is associated with the light side of the Force. Like, change the perception, you know? But I don't know. I mean, we're dealing with a timeline where in The Force Awakens, Finn and Rey are like, you know, Jedi. That's just myths and fairy tales. And they're barely even 20 years, 30 years away from, you know, where the events of the Battle of Endor happened. And so it's already kind of ghost stories. So, like, no one's going to remember the Emperor in another 30 years the way that they seem to do this in this universe, especially on these backwater planets. So anyway, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that you can, you know, try to make the way that the Rise of Skywalker wrap things up be a little bit better. And I think one of the problems of the movie, because it has so many holes, that's why you see so many fan theories, is because everybody is just unsatisfied. They're like, no, they didn't. You were supposed to wrap it up and you asked more questions than you answered. Like, you know, it's...
Well, the thing is that they've obviously finished the Skywalker saga. But they still are going to be producing more movies going forward, without a doubt. And I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of go, well, the saga is finished, but we still want something to springboard from. So those questions that have kind of been left answered, I'm wondering if those are sort of side threads that they're going to use that to split off to whatever movie series that they have coming afterwards. Just kind of going, okay, now we just got to pick up something just out of the blue from somewhere else.
I really like Daisy Ridley, and I really like the characters of Rey. I'm kind of disappointed that these characters introduced into Star Wars in Poe and Rey are basically being used to wrap up the Skywalker saga, as opposed to being the beginning of their own thing.
That is the one thing that I feel is a shame with her picking up the Skywalker name, is that it kind of signifies that she's not coming back, or if so, not in a big capacity, more as a cameo.
Yeah,
she'll be like the Lando Calrissian of the new series kind of thing.
Yeah. I know. I like I said with the new series, I would love for them to just go either so far in the future it doesn't matter, or so far in the past it doesn't matter. like not like prequel levels, but I'm talking like, you know, thousands of years before any of this mattered.
Like the Old Republic.
Yeah,
basically.
Old Republic stuff. Like that to me would be more interesting. But we can move on to what we have been watching this week. And if you haven't been able to tell, I have been under the weather this week. So I had a lot of time to watch Netflix. Not that I normally have this kind of downtime, but when you are sick, you take advantage. And I have a couple of quick mentions before we talk about the big beast in the room. But I took in the WB. Is it still the WB? I can't remember. CW? Something like that.
CW.
Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover. Wow. Weak sauce. Like, I was on board from the trailers with the cameos and the Brendan Routh is like Kingdom Come Superman and like all this kind of different stuff. But I have not watched anything from the Arrowverse of shows in a very long time. And for good reason. The dialogue was absolute drivel. You and I texted back and forth a little bit while I was watching them, and I was being grumpy and snarky, but I don't think any of it was really unwarranted. Like, I know I was sick, and I know I was kind of like, you know, my patience was probably pretty thin, but like, it was terrible. I have never seen so many characters at the edge of, we have to be heroes and save the universe, mope, cry, have the longest conversations with teammates when time is of the essence, and the same conversation in every single episode. It was terrible.
I also loved your comment about how they basically just stand there and do the Care Bear stare.
Oh, dude. So in order to defeat the Anti-Monitor, which is a dumb name, and probably from the comics, and that's fine, and they do a decent job of that, in that anytime someone mentions the Anti-Monitor in the show, one of the other characters kind of sneers their nose and goes, really? That's what he's called? Like, it's just that I did find kind of funny. And it's usually the straight men, like it's like Arrow, you know, or you know, Barry, or somebody that's not necessarily the funny one, you know, kind of like, that is the dumbest name ever. Who comes up with this stuff? And like that to me was at least a little bit tongue in cheek, but the rest of it was just so sad. And then to defeat them, they have these paragons of truth, courage, love, something, 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 honor. I don't remember all seven of them, including one of them that was Lex Luthor, which is also terrible. And they basically stare at Oliver Queen, who is no longer the Arrow, he is now some sort of specter, fighting the Anti-Monitor, and they just stare and think about their virtue, and that is what recreates the entire universe. It's like, I have seen deeper plots in kids' cartoons for six-year-olds. Like, it was
Captain Planet first up.
Yeah.
It was very Captain Planet.
It was. The Care Bear reference is the one that I made, just kind of showing my age. But yeah, like, the thing is, like, I like a lot of these actors. I like Brendan Routh. I like Melissa Benoist. Like, I like a lot of the characters in the shows. The writing for them is terrible. And I just feel bad for the shows.
I will agree with that. I actually stopped watching Arrow, which was one of my favorites of them. And it's just, as time got on, it's just like, really? It jumped the shark. It should have ended like a season or two ago.
Oh, easily.
You know, and the writing is just getting a lot more lackluster. It's it feels lazy. It's also feeling dated because everything's going towards long form storytelling. Mm-hmm. But this is still stuck in an episodic format of everything is wrapped up in a nice pretty bow by the end of the episode, which doesn't captivate anybody anymore.
No.
But the thing that kind of kept me going was just all of the cameos.
Right.
You know, seeing all these people sort of in there and seeing how they've managed to interconnect every single piece of the DC franchise, whether it be stuff that we've seen on television, stuff in the movies, and it's all kind of comes together as its own part of the multiverse. And I thought that in itself was a good concept that was well done, and that was what kept me watching and kept me excited, because every time it was like, oh, this person's in it, and so is that, you know, like Kevin Conroy playing Batman, actually getting to see the cartoon voiceover actually in a live action role for it, you know.
That was really cool. Yeah, and they did a nice reveal on that, because he says something to Kate, who plays Batwoman. He says something to her coming down the stairs, and you hear him before you see him. And everybody of a certain age just kind of went, oh, is that who I think it is? like I'm sure everyone's ears picked up because like it sounds just like what, you know, obviously he sounds just like the cartoons you remember. Plus he's been the voice of a lot of the Arkham games and stuff too, right?
Yeah. He's like the de facto voice. Yeah.
The thing that I found disappointing was with the cameos is that they're feel bad notes. Like Kevin Conroy comes back as Batman, which is awesome, but he's an evil Batman. Like he's a murderer. It's like, well, why do I want my favorite cartoon voice to come back as this evil twist? Or it's just lackluster. Again, Tom Welling, it was fun to see him, you know, kind of back in the Clark Kent role, but he's on the farm and he doesn't have any superpowers. He apparently gave them up so he could have kids with Lois, which I've never heard that in any of the Superman lore. And maybe I just don't know. Maybe it's a comic series that I missed out on, but it sounds boring. Why do I want a Superman with no superpowers? Like that to me just doesn't.
I will defend that one, however, because in Superman 2, he does do that exact thing. He does give up his powers for Lois.
Right.
And I can see that in Smallville, with the way that that went, I can see him sticking to that rather than reversing course on it.
So, I mean, it makes for an okay movie, I guess, in the 80s for that kind of a track. But he gets them back because he has to save the world. That's the whole thing, is that you can't give up your powers as Superman. The responsibility is yours and you can't just shrug it off because you want to have kiddos. Mm. And I liked the presence. Like, I mean, Tom Welling's a big dude and he played that role for a long time and played it very well. So that kind of stuff was fun. I didn't enjoy the conversation with Lex. Like Lex shows up with this book of destiny. He's like, oh my God, like does this stuff never end? Whereas I feel like if they had just left it at, you know, just him running into the other guardians and not the other guardians, the other legends, and just them realizing that he didn't have the powers and that he wasn't the right Superman, then that would have been fine. And that would have been a nice little cameo nod, and I would have been okay with that. So I do enjoy Ralph as Superman. I think he does a decent job. He's a good Clark Kent for sure. But I if I was to take away anything from the show, I learned the most about Batwoman. Now I've never seen the series. I did recognize the actor though. She was in John Wick 2. And she played, I think she played a deaf or a mute assassin. Anyway, she's an action, you know, action star. I like her presence. I find that she does the whole gruff kind of Batman-esque thing very well. Have you watched any of the Batwoman show?
I have, yes. I'm a little behind. I've not seen the last two, maybe three episodes.
I'd imagine it follows the same formula as everything else.
Kind of, yeah. It's kind of dark in the way that the Arrow was, especially at the beginning. You know, and it has like a descendant of I've forgotten what his name is.
Alfred?
Alfred, yes. I think it's like a descendant of Alfred is basically like watching over the Batcave and stuff, and Batman's no longer there and stuff. It's good. I'm not enthralled to kind of keep going back yet, so it's not really gripped me in that way. I've always just kind of been catching up at times where it's just like there's literally nothing else for me to watch right now.
Yeah.
And it's one of those I should really keep looking just in case it kind of picks up. So I'm going to go until the end of season one, but if it's not picking me up by the end of season one, then I'm not going to tune in for season two.
The one interesting thing that, the one interesting thing that they left the Crisis on Infinite Earths, off on was that the result, is that at least there was an honest to goodness death. Oliver Queen died. I mean, spoilers, I guess. You'd have to be under a rock. These are old shows. These are weeks old now.
And the Arrow series is finished as well.
Yeah, like don't. Yeah, like don't like listen to me. Don't go watch these. But they left it in a way where all the Infinite Earths now, they're all one. So you've got Supergirl and the Flash and Legends and all these kind of heroes on the same Earth instead of in parallel Earths now, which I thought was something they should have maybe done a long time ago. Maybe from the start.
It fixes a lot of headaches for the writers.
A lot of headaches for the writers. It means that when one of these series is flailing, they can get a cameo from like Supergirl, or, you know, like they can start to do, because ultimately the Crisis stuff is terrible, but like the crossovers probably are the closest to a comic series than any other kind of like villain of the week stuff. And I feel like they probably are, you know, trying to wrap it up in a way that they can be in the shows more often, like crossover into other shows more often. Maybe they'll take a page from your book and get into more longer term, you know, like get a 3-episode arc where, you know, episode 1 is on Supergirl, episode 2 is on Legends, you know, episode 3 is wrapped up on Flash. You know, that would be probably, they would probably benefit from that if they try to start writing in that way. But they have to not recap the first, they can't spend the first 20 minutes of a 40-minute episode recapping what happened last time, because it's mind-numbing. Like, it's insulting as a viewer.
Yeah.
I can tell you briefly what does not do that is Titans on Netflix. I went on a superhero kick, and again, sick. I needed something I wanted to watch that I could just turn my brain off and just hit next. And I watched season 2 of Titans. No spoilers. I won't get into any details. Megan is watching it. We're probably going to talk about it on the Citadel Cafe in the coming weeks. It is much better than season 1. Season 1 wasn't bad. It just wasn't really my kind of show. I think they were also still finding their feet. It felt dark for the sake of being dark. The difference in season 2, and this isn't a spoiler, is that Deathstroke is the bad guy. And so that's in the trailers. He's a dark bad guy. Like, he's an assassin. He kills people. So there's this real mortal threat. And there's some decent character exploration, interesting casting, some flashbacks to fill in the gaps, some questions that you have about season 1. It's not perfect, but it is certainly way better than anything that the CW is putting out in the Arrowverse in terms of just entertainment value, production value, acting, dialogue. Like, it just, it's treated very professionally and it's not cranked out. Like, they took the time to make sure that this season long arc held up very well. There's only one departure, and it has to do with the origin of a new character, and they tie it in at the end of the episode, but they do kind of like send you on this side story to explore this new character. It's worth it, but it does feel a little bit out of place. It's also a very dark show, so it's not for kids. There's a lot of like bone breaking and stabbing, and there's a lot of swords and blood and violence and swearing. Wow, swearing. Lots of adult situations in terms of, like, you know, drug use and stuff like that. It's a harder hitting kind of series, but you're dealing with a bunch of teenage sidekicks that are all in the same place trying to be superheroes and failing at it. So there are going to be all kinds of frustrations. There's going to be some F-bombs. Like, that, you know, it's real in that way. And I think, not that I want, you know, Supergirl to start swearing left, right, and center, but I feel like the realism of Titans is something that could be lifted and applied to other superhero shows. Titans goes too far. It's its own little niche. And it does that little niche very well. But I'd like to see something a little bit grittier in some of the new superhero developments, if we get any, if people aren't burnt out on superheroes. Did you watch season 1 of Titans?
I haven't, no. To be honest, it's one that's completely passed me by. I've really not been paying much attention to Netflix lately, beyond Lost in Space. So, right. It, you know, that's something that I obviously need to sort of take a look in. And see if that's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we get into the big meat of the show, anything that you think is worth mentioning over the last few weeks that you've been watching?
Not in terms of watching, but a show that I've mentioned on this show before is Krypton, which I absolutely love. It's a prequel to Superman. And I found out some news from the most unlikely of sources about the show, because I went to Walmart today just to pick up some food and stuff, you know, as one does. And I end up going past the DVD aisle and notice that they've just released season 2 on DVD. And on the cover, it says the complete second and final season. And I was like, what? I'm like, final season? Wait. There was like, I was loving where it was going. What on earth? I go on Wikipedia and sure enough, it got cancelled.
Wow.
And I found that out from a DVD. I don't even buy DVDs anymore.
That's like, I'm surprised they still make DVDs. I haven't looked for a DVD in a long time.
Yeah, it may have been a Blu-ray. It may have been still, both, I mean, but it was physical media.
Yeah, that can't.
You don't normally find
well.
Out from physical media that a show that you like has been cancelled.
Yeah,
and so that I'm really disappointed with, because that was actually a really good show. You know, like, if you know, it's one of those. Don't really go watch the CW stuff because it's kind of gone. There was something I really liked about Krypton. I thought it was actually quite good.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think maybe that because of the nature of the show, they might have been able to take a different angle, because there was no expectations and they weren't trying to fit, like, you know, all the stuff together from the multiple Arrowverse shows and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know, I never did.
It was
watch
a very
Krypton.
Different tone.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a very different tone, and I can see that it wouldn't have picked up a popular audience. Mm. I just got it because I liked that it was doing something different. So,
well, and that's the thing, and thus. It got canceled. And this is the thing. It's doing something different and it gets canceled. So here's a lesson, folks.
It's the Firefly syndrome.
Yeah. All of these cookie cutter things that are on for season after season after season that we complain about on the show, they're there because the public is watching. So if you're picky and you feel the same way that we do, stop watching. stop support. They just make more. That's what happens. That's why there's 8 seasons of Arrow, is because it should have stopped at, like, I don't know, season 5, and they just kept going. But we're going to talk about a much better show. We're going to talk about Picard. So we've seen episodes 1, 2, and 3. I'll give a spoiler warning. We are going to get into a little bit. We're not going to go like scene by scene, but we're going to be able to talk about some broader strokes, I think. So if you haven't caught up on Picard, then you're going to want to do that before you listen to the next conversation. But in the meantime, I should tell you about the Internet Minute, which is brought to you by you. In case you're wondering, the Citadel Cafe is 100% listener supported. That means that if you're getting value out of the show, you could consider putting a little bit of value back in and become a member that helps us make more episodes. You can do that at patreon.com/thecitadelcafe. There's a number of levels, including a member-only Discord server, access to bonus episodes. A couple weeks back, we did a Star Wars episode and Johnny stuck around for half an hour. We talked about The Mandalorian some more. We talked about Star Wars. It was great. So if you're interested in that kind of thing and you would not like to join not the 19, but the now 20 members of our Patreon count, you can check that out at patreon.com/thecitadelcafe. My goal is to always have at least one more patron per month than we did the last. We kind of killed it in January, so thank you very much. We grew quite a bit. But again, there's always room for one more. I think you will enjoy the Discord. It's a fun, nerdy place to spend your week. And of course, you'll get access to different things when you're in there. So check that out at patreon.com/thecitadelcafe. And I will thank you very much. Now, you, sir, have brought the Internet Minute this week, and I cannot believe that this exists.
I know, right? So it's not available yet. It's available for pre-order, and they're estimating sometime between August of this year and January of next. But Sideshow Collectibles, who do insane quality collectible material, have done a life-sized figure of the child. You can get Baby Yoda completely life-size in amazing detail. And it is, in US dollars,
$350.
$350 American will get you a life-size Baby Yoda. Or $52.50 per month with a payment plan.
Oh, yeah, good. You know, for something that you can't have right now. For something that...
Yeah.
So the Lucasfilm and Disney... neither of whom need a loan, are currently accepting a interest-free loan of $350 per order between now and August 2020, when it's going to be first available. I can understand, but some things, like, I get the whole concept of Kickstarters. I run them myself sometimes, but pre-orders on stuff like this, like, this is the thing that is manufactured. Just make it. If you think people will buy it, just make it.
One of the things I loved, though, when I first saw this page, is that I looked down to see the size, and it's 16.5 inches tall. right? And underneath the picture, it says, how big is this collectible? View size comparison. And I was thinking, like, are they going to compare to other things? And you click on it, and there's just a silhouette of a guy stood behind it.
Yeah, there's like a drawing, kind of give you a drawing of someone. Yeah. It's not even a real person. I think there was one photo that has an apple.
An outline.
And it's like, well, I don't know. Yeah. Is that a big apple? Is it a small apple? I don't know. He looks to be about six apples tall. He's bigger than a Smurf.
And then there's some small print. Scale is approximate and should be used for rough comparisons only.
It's like, how is that life size?
What do you expect?
It's like, we've made a life size thing that we've licensed, but they didn't tell us how big the thing was, and we're going to charge you a lot of money because we're not sure. It's like, this is the thing that existed. It was a prop on the set. Find out how tall it is and make it the same. I don't know.
And if you're going to put it as a comparison, put it as a comparison to something which has a set size. Don't just put it next to a drawing of a human that could be any size.
Any size. Yeah.
Of course, it's approximate and for a rough comparison. Yeah.
Does one exist? Like it's hard to tell whether this is a CG render or whether it's a figure. It does look like a photo. Like it does look a photo of a sculpture, but
yeah, it's definitely a photo. Yeah. It's, I mean, just the way that the model is designed when you look at the cloth, I mean, obviously cloth is very, very easy to these days to make look realistic in CGI, but that looks like it's the real deal.
Yeah.
But I think that basically it's locked in, and it's probably just, they'll know that they'll need to make a ton of these things, mm-hmm. which is why it'll be still a ways off before they've produced enough of them.
Yeah. It is kind of funny that he's holding the little ball controller from the Mandalorian ship.
Yeah. In fact, it does say prototype shown.
So
that it does actually say that it says that when the final production piece may differ in appearance.
Yeah.
So he may have a mohawk or something. I don't know.
Yeah, he may. I don't know. If I'm paying $350, it better look exactly like that photo. that's, right. So
yeah.
If I'm paying $350 for a baby Yoda, it better be able to levitate something in my office on command. You know, or heal. Like if I get a paper cut working. I need to be able to touch Baby Yoda and have it heal me. Like this is the expectation. Anyway.
But there we go. That's something that exists. And so yes. I thought I should bring that with me.
Oh, internet. You're a wonderful place sometimes. Star Trek Picard. You, I think, mentioned this on our Christmas wrap-up, I think, in terms of something you were looking forward to in the new year. Obviously, it's been out for 3 weeks. The third episode just came out today, February 6th. Both you and I had a chance to watch that before the show.
I was watching it at 6 a.m. this morning.
I didn't watch it. I forgot about it. I didn't watch about it over breakfast. I should have, because I was up at that time too. But I watched it over lunch. So we're going to give a little bit of a spoiler warning here. We can't get into it without kind of ruining it. And I think... it's one of those things
that
it's such a fun experience to have not knowing anything. Cause I went in blind. I think I only ever watched one trailer and then just kind of didn't bother with anything else. Not that I didn't want to. I just thought, you know, this is going to be something I'm really going to like, and I'm going to go into it not knowing anything and just kind of see how much they tell me. And so, yeah, if you haven't seen it, then we would not want to take that experience from you. So go watch it and then come back to us later. But I want to say just off the start, because I'm going to let you do most of the talking. I just really enjoy the feeling that the show puts out there. It's new.
Mm.
It's fresh. It doesn't feel like they're retreading, but there's a lot that feels familiar. And yet it's written and given to you in like a good mystery. Something dramatic happens in the first episode and you're just like, what the crap just happened? And then it just opens up and they explain, you know, kind of where it's going. And then you're like, oh, wow, I am so on board. Like I was on board because I wanted to explore the first things that they set up, which was the Romulan sun going supernova or just dying. I can't remember.
Yes.
Which.
Yeah, supernova. Which was something established in the JJ movies.
Oh, was it? Okay, I didn't realize that. Or I did realize it and I didn't remember it. It's more likely. So that I thought was an excellent thing because, of course, the last thing I remember about the Next Generation is that Romulans are the bad guys. You know, Picard has got a very long and storied history with the Borg, also a fantastic friendship with Data. And then if you go into the movies, of course, Data, you know, dies in, I think, Nemesis?
It is in Nemesis, yeah. Which was so back in 2002.
Yeah, so he dies in Nemesis, saving Picard and the crew and all that kind of stuff. And so they pick up with Picard, and they give you this whole tragedy of the Romulan evacuation failing, Picard leaving Starfleet, and thus retiring to his family vineyard. And this is kind of where you find him. And I just, the way that they set that up, it plants enough seeds and gives you enough information to kind of really give you a clear picture of what Picard has potentially gone through. They don't spell it out for you, but they kind of give you this, something tragic has happened, and you're seeing it in him, but you're also hearing the big bulletins, the big headlines about what happened. But what you want to know is the nuance, right? What you want to know is the detail. And that to me is what has kept me going through the first couple of episodes, including the tie backs to more familiar faces and stuff. But I mean, I think it's been a treat. What were your first impressions after just kind of like that first episode?
I was captivated just from the opening scene, which told you so, so much about where Picard is at, where he's been, without you even being told what's happened. Because it opens with him having a dream. And the last time we saw that happening was in First Contact, where it was a bit of a nightmare kind of scenario that was going on. So, you know, whenever you're being shown a Picard dream, there's significance to it. And it opens with a shot of space, and you hear him singing Blue Skies, which is something that Data sang at Troy and Riker's wedding. And then you see the Enterprise D, and it goes straight into 10 Forward, which is just absolutely beautiful. And you've got him playing poker, which is something he never really got to do until the final episode.
Right.
And he's playing it with Data, who is wearing his Nemesis uniform. So it's out of place. So you know that there's something that's not quite right there.
Mm.
And then you have them at Mars, which he knows isn't right, that they shouldn't be there. And then Mars is exploding. You can see just fire, you know, surrounding the planet. And you just know that there's basically been something tragic has gone on, but also he's not gotten over what happened with Data, and that is something that has touched him so profoundly. And so from that moment, I was captivated as to what was happening. There'd been a short trek where they kind of shown from the perspective of a couple of school children what the attack on Mars was like. So we kind of seen a little bit of that without it really spoiling anything, which was really good. But to kind of go from there, sort of seeing, Picard on his family vineyard, which again is something that's been established that in an alternate future from All Good Things, that's where he was. His brother and his nephew and his brother's wife, you know, they all died in a fire, as mentioned in Star Trek Generations. So it kind of makes sense that that he would go back there. But at the same time, he never wanted to work on the vineyard. That wasn't his place. His place was in space. So again, why is he here? Why has he left Starfleet? What would make him actually resign? And so when they have the interview with the press and he's being pushed, that moment when he said, because it's no longer Starfleet, is just such a shocking thing that... because Picard has always stood up for his values, and if Starfleet is no longer Starfleet to the point that it's forced him to leave, I mean, that is huge and has massive repercussions to it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the weight that they put behind that, and there's a lot of things about his performance that kind of start there. Like, you get kind of like, she gets under his skin, the interviewer gets under his skin, and he kind of snaps a bit. So you get a more emotional side of Picard in some points, but not a lot of it. And then in others, you get the very familiar to the point, you know, he's very direct, obviously intelligent, you know, like very patient. You know, it's a very nuanced performance, but it's the same Picard. Mind you, he's changed by years and age and, you know, the events that have taken place. They weigh on him, but you still get this very familiar kind of feeling. You know, something crazy happens and he's very calm, you know, very collected. This girl, I can't remember her name, not Asha. What's the name of the...
Dodge.
Dodge is this girl that shows up. And she turns out to be a synthetic, but when she shows up, she's just this girl in a cloak. She's panicked and she's a stranger. And he's like, how the heck did you get on the property? His dog is going bananas. And then the dog goes up and actually likes her, like realizes that, you know, she's not a threat. And, but Picard is just like, who are you and how did you get here? Like, he's asking questions. He's not like threatening. He's not like, how did you get on my property? He's just like, huh? Who are you? Like, it's just, he's the curiosity that always comes out in Picard, I find very, very interesting. And also very nurturing is that he's like, okay, well, I've established that I don't know who you are. You're in distress. You obviously need help. I don't feel like you're a threat to me, so I'm therefore going to help you. And he has that, it just has that warmth to him that I think is really cool. I like how they took that reveal of Dodge being a synthetic, and then also Picard having to, because the whole time you're just like, okay, well, how does she know him and how are they tied together? And then they're exploring this kind of stuff, and he goes and talks to, I can't remember, no, this was after she died, but there's these moments where you're trying to rack your memory about Star Trek, you know, lore, and it's like, where the crap did this come from? And then you it's revealed that she looks like a painting that Data made from years ago. And I was like, that is just a brilliant, subtle tie-in. And even if, and you can answer me this question because you will probably know, even if they made this up for just this series, it feels like an Easter egg that I would have been able to notice in Next Generation, you know, season 5 or something, you know, Data painting something, right? Because I remember that he painted. Like, I knew that.
Oh, he painted so many paintings.
Right.
On that show.
Is that one of them? Yeah. Is that for real, or did they make it up for for Picard?
To be honest, I don't know. For the exact same reasons as yourself. I mean, there's
February
been so many.
6th, 2020, Alistair doesn't know. kidding, of course. But yeah, like that. But it, even if they did make it up for just this specific show, the fact that you knew Data painted, you knew he did more than one, you knew it was something that was intriguing to him.
It was still in his style as well.
Yeah. Everything makes sense. Like, you don't question the fact. You don't go, oh yeah, that's really convenient. You go, oh wow, I wonder where that is. You're like, you know what I mean? Like, you don't think, ah, nah, that's a nice twist. You think like, man, where did I miss that? You know, like, you're trying to figure it all out. So, again, I thought it was really, really good. And what, cause I think it's in the first episode that Dodge dies. I think so.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah.
And I was just like, whoa, wait, cause that happened. I'm just like, okay, wait a minute. Is Picard still dreaming? What's going on? And the fact that they have this reveal of this very special android, supposedly, you know, somehow Data's daughter or the equivalent therein, dying in the first episode, I thought, where the hell do they go from here? And then Picard goes and talks to, I can't remember her name, but she's the doctor.
Agnes Duarte, who's played by Alison Pill, who is fantastic.
Yes,
actually, she's
very, very
response.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. Just her response of just bursting into laughter and then be like, oh, you're serious.
Yeah. 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 No, I thought she was really good too. I really enjoy her performance as well. She's got this great, like, fish, not fish out of water, but like, she's a scientist and she eats, sleeps, and breathes her work in synthetics, but she's not Starfleet. She's not military. There's been no training. She doesn't have that kind of gusto about her. She's still very mousy and very. She's very nerdy. Like, she's the Star Trek. She's the Star Trek fan on set. You know what I mean? Like, not literally. I mean, I'm sure she is, but like, she's got that kind of vibe to her. And then she reveals that the only way to make a synthetic in this way would be to have it be twins. And so it's revealed that even though Dodge died, there's still another one. Because I remember thinking like, well, that sucks. Because I really like Issa Briones, who plays Dodge, and her sister. And I was like, I was disappointed when she dies. Like, I was really enjoying this girl's performance. I'm kind of mad that this is over. And then I was relieved to say, like, oh, wait a minute. I mean, I'm still kind of frustrated because I really enjoyed the dynamic that she has with Patrick Stewart. So we haven't seen them together since, because of course, it's revealed that the other sister, I don't remember her name, is on another, not even on another planet. She's out in space somewhere. But yeah, like, it just, I really enjoy the way that they set up that first episode of giving you all of these great tidbits. This crazy thing happens that normally doesn't happen in these first episodes. Like, this, the kind of writing that's happening here is intelligent writing. Like, it's, they're giving you breadcrumbs. Mm. They're explaining enough to make sure that you're not wondering why characters have motivation. So I'm not seeing anything that's happening by characters and wondering, why are they like that? Is it just because the script says so? Like, even something as subtle as the two housemates that Picard has, who are both Romulan, and then you realize that they're loyal to him because he probably saved their lives.
Yeah.
Right?
And the Romulans were always like a big thing for Picard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously you always had this kind of, you know, this cold stance that you were describing before. That was always the thing in The Next Generation, that they were the enemy that could attack any time. They just, there was that neutral zone that they had to stay on the other side of. But Picard had been instrumental in trying to bring the Vulcans and Romulans together through unification, which was a project that Spock had dedicated the latter part of his life to. And then in Nemesis, he comes to help the Romulans, and it's established that that is like hopefully the first step towards true peace between the Federation and the Romulan Star Empire. And so when you find out that when Romulus is in peril and Starfleet decided not to help, then that's a bit of a problem. And it's understandable as to why Picard would be so against it, especially as it's already been established in Star Trek VI that when the Klingon moon Praxis explodes and that the Klingons are in trouble, Spock makes a big deal of, we need to help the Klingons. You know, it's kind of our responsibility as Starfleet to do so. And, you know, I mean, you've got Kirk going, you know, let them die, because he's got a little bit of a grudge at the fact that they killed his son, you know. But from the Starfleet point of view, the right thing to do was to help the Klingons, considered some of the mortal enemies of the Federation. And we're going through that exact same thing again, but this time Starfleet are against helping the Romulans. And that's where Picard has such a big issue with it, and rightly so.
And they really haven't, I mean, granted, we're all kind of like, you know, obviously fans of Picard, and you're rooting for him, but you don't tend to have a lot of love for the Starfleet in this. Like, they don't paint them in great light. Like, his encounters with going back to Starfleet to ask for a ship to go look for this girl are denied. He's laughed out. Even when he's first there, the up-nosed kid that kind of signs him in is like, who are you? What's your name? Like, you know, and he spells it out, and good to see you up and around, and kind of rolls his eyes. Even the more pleasant interactions with Starfleet are still like insulting. And you're just like, wow, Starfleet feels shallow in this show. Like, they haven't revealed much outside of Starfleet being completely infiltrated by Romulan spies, which this is the only part of the plot so far that I find difficult at the moment. I can't pass judgment because it's only three episodes. But the rescue attempt to save the Romulans was being staged on Mars, and then synthetics went haywire and blew everything to crap, and it killed something crazy like 90,000 people or something like that, or 900. I can't remember. It was a lot.
And destroyed Utopia Planitia, which is where their shipyards are, where they build all the ships.
Right. So it really ransacked the Federation, and a lot of, they felt that the help effort was destroyed probably by Romulans, and then they're like, well, all right, well, if you are going to bite the hand that's trying to save you, then screw you. You're on your own. And the idea is that, what's the name of the Zat Vash are this like deep rooted secret service in the Romulan Empire. And the idea is that they are behind it because they have this one track, one mission of being wholly against any kind of synthetics, androids. And it's revealed in the second episode that I think that the Zatvash are not just infiltrating Starfleet, but they're at the top. The chief of security for Starfleet is in league with these evil Romulans.
Not only that, she is one, but disguised cleverly as a Vulcan.
As a Vulcan, right. And there was another one that was disguised as a human, I guess, too.
Yes.
But it's just like, it's one of those things where it's like, wow, okay. I guess I don't understand the weight of the attack on Mars and how vulnerable that might have made the Federation. Because I always thought, especially in the Next Generation kind of situation, that the Federation was pretty widespread. And granted, they always had some of their enemies, because otherwise it would be a boring show. There was just it was such a huge sort of positive kind of future. I just didn't think that any kind of espionage would get to that level. Does that make sense? Like, it feels out of place at the moment, but I think it might be just because I'm pushing too much of the Next Generation timeline on this one.
Well, you've got the Federation, which, as you say, is just like a massive body of all of these different species and things. Mm-hmm. Starfleet is just the military branch of that, which is, you know, based on Earth. The fleet's always built at Utopia Planitia, orbiting Mars. And it does seem that if you have somebody who has managed to pose as a Vulcan and get to the rank of Commodore,
right,
that this has been a this has been the long con, basically.
Right, yeah.
It's been something that they've been working on for a very long time, and likely when, you've got to think this show is based 20 years after we saw Nemesis, and Next Generation ended, way earlier than that. And so right when you've got the Romulans and the Federation who are really kind of against each other at that point, it could easily have been as early as then, if not before then, that you would have this super secret branch in the same way that the Federation had Section 31. That they would infiltrate just to kind of keep an eye on things and to get to that level, because they likely were in a rush to do that.
I'm glad that they kind of have her as a Vulcan, because it kind of excuses the wooden delivery from some of the lines, because you're kind of used to that from Vulcans. It's the only weak point of the show, I think, is just the Commodore and all that stuff just kind of feels very familiar in a bad way. Like, it's just the kind of stuff, like, I've seen this in TV shows before, the spy infiltration. We, the audience, know, but the people that were, the characters in the show don't know. I get far too much enjoyment out of the other stuff to find that being a huge fault. Like, I think that it's one of those things where it's like, okay, now it's the dark broody spy scene between brother and sister where they're kind of flirting, and it's like, you guys need to stop. It's all stuff that I've kind of seen before. Whereas everything with Picard, with the Girardi, I'm trying to think, is it Narek? I can't remember the two.
So Narek is Narek is that guy. There's also Raffi, who is she's post TNG, but she's had quite a long period of working with Picard.
So I'm thinking of the two Romulans that live with him.
Zaban and Laris.
Right. So the dynamics between them, I find just so enjoyable that it overshadows anything that is lackluster. Like, you've got this, there's this great communication about of the relationship that they have, that it's both like loyalty, but also friendship, also family. Like, they love him, but then they also obey him in a certain, like to a certain extent, you know? And then on the flip side, they also boss him around.
They respect him to where the respect is required.
Yeah. And but yeah. And then at
they
the same
also
time...
are caring for him and looking out for his interests. And if the interest in for his care outweighs the respect, then they will go at him.
Yeah. It's great. It's got a great dynamic. I mean, to the point where like in the first episode, he walks up to a replicator and he asks for Earl Grey decaf. And you in your brain, you went, what? That's not what he normally says. But then later on, you kind of think like, if he had just ordered Earl Grey hot, you could imagine the scolding look he would have gotten from one or the other, right? It's like, you're sure? It's like, yes, I'm fine. You know, like just, it's don't tell me what to drink sort of stuff. Like I just, you get that kind of dynamic of like living with people for 14 years, you know, like that kind of thing, really comes through.
There's two characters that I love that they have in this show. One of them we have not seen, the other one we've seen briefly. So for the latter, it's the doctor, his physician, Dr. Benayoun, his name is.
I think you're right.
He has, because I was watching that episode with Megan, and Megan was like, is this a guy who's been before? And I'm like, I'm pretty sure he has not. But it's established that, and that is the case. This is the character's first ever mention, appearance. But he is the doctor that was on board the Stargazer. And one of the things about Picard's career is that he was on the Enterprise D for 8 years. He was on the USS Stargazer for 22 years. So the fact that he is going to this position that has obviously been a friend of his for a lot longer than any of the Enterprise D, I think is actually quite heartwarming.
Interesting.
For that.
I didn't...
And the other one...
I recognize the actor. I feel like I've seen him in a bunch of other things. I could have sworn he was in Star Trek, but...
David Paymer. He's got a very familiar face. I can't think off the top of my head what he's been in, but I know he's done like a lot of character acting.
Oh, for sure.
So just a lot of bit parts and stuff.
Yeah.
But the other name that keeps coming up is Bruce Maddox.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if you remember who Bruce Maddox was, because he has actually been in Next Gen.
So I know the name for that, probably that reason, for that kind of like familiarity to it. I will probably know, like if they're bringing back the same actor, I'll probably recognize him because I did watch the full
I'm
series.
Really hoping they do. Yeah. I'm hoping that we actually get to see him again. Mm. So he was a scientist working at the Daystrom Institute, which this is also the first time we've ever seen the Daystrom Institute. We've heard about it a lot. It was named after Richard Daystrom, who was in the original series, The Ultimate Computer. Mm. But in The Measure of a Man, it's when Bruce Maddox comes on board to disassemble Data, and so there's a whole court hearing as to whether or not he's sentient and whether he has the right to say no and to not be disassembled, and at the end of the episode Data doesn't have any hard feelings because he doesn't have feelings and he's still willing to work with him. So there's a couple of episodes, like there's Contagion, there's Data's Day, where Bruce Maddox is brought up. Data is constantly writing to him. And like there's one time where he's basically writing a diary about his day and, you know, sending it to Bruce Maddox. So all this time, he's still been working with Data. And so when we see on Mars, we've got these very Data-like androids where they've got the gold skin, they've got the gold eyes. I think it was it F8?
I think that was
something 8 for the android that kind of goes crazy. There's still an element of that is a Soong-type android. But you can tell it's not quite there.
Yeah.
And it also kind of brings in a lot of the questions that Picard had when he's talking with Guinan about the fact that, you know, they're talking about a disposable workforce. And that was all bringing up a lot of things about slavery. I mean, the word slavery is actually mentioned in The Measure of a Man. So the fact that they've taken this little thread from one episode that kind of weaved its way into a couple of other episodes and is now like the core basis of Picard is just fascinating to me. And the fact that they're now on the hunt to see, can we find Bruce Maddox, because he's the key to all this, is quite exciting.
Yeah, no, I'm on board. Like I've really enjoyed the first few episodes. I mean, it's one of those things where like I like Patrick Stewart so much, and I like Star Trek, so I knew that I was going to like it, given, you know, that it was going to be on streaming, and that, you know, if they go back into this, knowing how well established a Star Trek is as a brand, like they would have all the money they would ever need to make this show. And it looks fantastic. Like you don't wonder for a second how they're doing it. The sets, and especially some of the outdoor things, like the campuses where he goes to Starfleet and all that kind of stuff, it all feels very real. Like they do a fantastic job with it.
I love that they have shuttles with that say taxi on the side. But you can beam, like they've got these little arches that you can go in and that will beam you to places. So they do have like transport set up, but for places where you're not going to beam to, or, you know, if you just don't want to be able to beam, they still run taxi services. Yeah. And I think that's hilarious.
Yeah.
And also just like what you're saying about the way everything looks, like the way that they've updated the look of the Borg cube, like the Borg alcoves, the new design for that just looks fantastic because it still harkens back to every design we've seen, but still feels more modern and more detailed than we've ever had before.
And they refer to this as the Borg artifact. And that was revealed, I think, in the second episode, because this is where Daj's sister is located. The other synthetic that Picard is looking for is on this this Borg artifact that is controlled by the Romulans, it feels like.
Yes, yeah, they are kind of in charge of it. They are stripping Borg components. I feel like there's two different directives on this. You've got the Romulans who just want the technology to be able to sell on. And then you have other people who are involved in removing that technology, but their priority is about, you know, giving a sense of individuality back to people who were captured by the Borg, you know, to the people who were assimilated, and to try and rehabilitate them. So there's two different kind of focuses there, because you've got the fact that, yes, the Borg are this big evil race. At the same time, they're made up of victims. Every single member of the Borg Collective was taken against their will.
Right.
You know, and, you know, they're trying to rehabilitate them back into having some sense of individuality. And I also love that Hugh is back. A Borg that was rescued by the Enterprise and who gained some sense of individuality, which also kind of spread to some other Borg drones from his cube. And since then, he's managed to get even more, like, you can tell that he's not as like a Borg as he was. He's gained a lot more humanity because he just feels a lot more natural now.
I didn't realize this was the same actor.
Yeah, it's Jonathan Del Arco.
Oh yeah, so I didn't recognize him at all.
Yeah, so this has been like 25 years since he was last seen.
Right.
At least, you know, so in that time, it's kind of understandable that he would be a little bit more natural. But the thing is that they've not really called attention to it. It's just, you know, he's mentioned as being Hugh, but there's not been any like, oh, hey, you were on the Enterprise and
right.
You this and that. Like there's none of this kind of sure, nothing like what the CW would do, basically, where the CW would spend half an hour going over it over and over.
Yeah, exactly.
And I like that because it's not relevant. You know, it's not something that would naturally come up in conversation.
I wonder, if we're going to get
Picard meets him.
Yeah, I'd say if Picard meets him, then that's going to be an interesting exchange.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's going to be when that stuff kind of comes up, when it's like, Hugh, after all this time.
Yeah. I'm not surprised that the Borg are in it or featured heavily in it, given how big an antagonist they play in Picard's overall story. I'm hoping they do something different with it. And
that's interesting that you say that, because that is very much the concern that Patrick Stewart had.
Right.
He didn't want to deal with the Borg. I mean, he didn't even want to come back and play the role.
Yes.
Unless something was, you know, until he found out, one, Michael Chabon, Akiva Goldsman, Kristen Bayer, that they were all kind of writing and producing the show. And he just knew there was so much talent there that he had to work with them. And from the writing in these first three episodes, I'm not surprised. Mm-hmm. But he also didn't just want to have the Borg in for the Borg's sake, because he's like, we've had the Borg so much. That's kind of been told. But this is very different, and that's the reason why it's there. You know, we're not dealing with the Borg as the Borg threat. We are dealing with a cube that's been long since separated from the collective, I think that there's a sign. I love the sign. It says, "This facility has gone 5,843 days without an assimilation."
Yeah.
I just love that little workforce sign. Mm-hmm. But it is very different, and I don't think that we're going to get the same kind of Borg story that we've had before.
Right. The Borg done? I don't remember. Were they defeated, or were they just basically defeated enough?
Yes. There's not been any concrete thing in either sense, but the idea is that they've not been defeated, is my understanding. At the end of Voyager, they were given a crippling blow. Their entire transwarp hub network, which is basically just a series of tunnels that they can use to get around the galaxy very, very quickly, has been destroyed. So now their ships are kind of stranded and only able to go at warp speeds. So they can't zip around a lot quicker than they previously would have done.
Right.
And so that's going to have hampered them quite a bit. So Earth is safe for the most part for quite some time now.
Remind me, timeline-wise, where does Voyager happen in relation to Next Gen?
So Next Gen, in terms of... like in universe, that was 2370 is when TNG ended. Nemesis was 2379 because it was just shy of a decade afterwards. Voyager would have ended. I can't remember if Voyager ended before or after Nemesis. I think it was slightly after. So that's kind of where it's at.
So Voyager happens now, between the Star Trek Next Gen series and the movies is when the Voyager
yes.
stuff is all happening.
Yeah. So yeah, because you had TNG was on the air and then DS9 started. Mm-hmm. And so there's a bit of a crossover there. And then DS9 had a bit of a crossover as Voyager launched, because Voyager actually launches from Deep Space Nine.
Right.
From the station there. In terms of kind of the time frame for this, because you've got Nemesis in 2379. You've got the attack on Mars was like 2385, and then this show,
they have it in the Wikipedia actually, just hold on.
Yeah. And it's 2399, is when Picard is set. It's set just shy of the 25th century.
Yeah. So in 2385, 2 years prior to the Romulan supernova, an attack on rogue synthetics results in the destruction of the Armada tasked with evacuating Romulan system. So 2385 is the attack on Mars.
Yeah. And just having a quick look here in terms of Voyager, it's 2404 is when it was kind of set in the future. It's 2378 is the year that they end up coming back and defeating the Borg. So 2378, and so that's a year before Nemesis, before the events of that. So a year before Data sacrifices himself.
Right. Interesting. Cool. Yeah, I just, like I said, it's really starting to ramp up now. You and I finished the third episode, which I think kind of pushed the plot forward in that we're really starting to get going now, in that it was about Picard recruiting an old friend, getting a new ship. We get introduced to some new characters, and also have some pretty fun moments, I think, throughout the show. There's a fair bit of Borg stuff. You get a little bit more background into why the Romulans are researching and doing what they're doing on the Borg artifact. But I mean, the highlight of the third episode for me was like the last 5 minutes.
Absolutely.
When Picard gets the crew together, I actually had to rewind it because I couldn't tell whether it was just by chance that they survived the attack at the chateau, or whether it was someone just being like super well trained and stuff. And it was kind of this nice reminder that the two Romulans that live with Picard are like taking care of him, but they're also like trained Romulans, like they, you know, when they get attacked,
and they have weapons all over the place.
Yeah, that was the other thing, is that even Picard has got weapons all over the place. It's like it was a little bit strange that he had that kind of stuff around, but I mean, I guess you know, either at their behest or at his after, you know, after certain events that we don't know about. But yeah, like this, they get attacked in their home by the same assassins that took out Dodge in the first episode, and they win. But the first one, like, I think his male companion drops an apple or something on the floor, and he goes to pick it up. And when he goes to pick it up, he dodges by millimeters this disruptor bolt that goes over his head.
Pure fluke.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Fluke. I thought that he like ducked on purpose, but like, no, he totally, it was just luck. It was a great firefight. Lots of really good action and not, it wasn't too drug out, which was nice, but then.
I love Juati's response as well.
Yeah.
She's kind of like, maybe he's stunned. So the Romulans are like, there's no stun setting on disruptors.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I really,
yeah, which is very Romulan. Like the Romulans just, not bother with a stun setting. It's like, exactly. No, we're Romulans.
Yeah.
It doesn't come with that feature.
And I like that it has this combination. I'm kind of disappointed that his two Romulan buddies didn't go with him. But it has this, like, I finally convinced my old compatriot to come with me. I've got this ragtag of like hired hotshot, grumpy old friend who doesn't want to be here. And this like wide-eyed, nerdy, companion of happenstance that's coming on the crew, because she says so. He's like, you have to take me with you because I think they're trying to kill me too, sort of thing. It's just like, it makes a lot of sense.
And it's a compelling argument that, you know, that Picard would just be like, yeah, well, absolutely. I will buy that. Like,
she's also the leading most authority on synthetics on the planet, which makes sense too.
That's it. Yeah. So like, and especially if they're going to be finding Boost Maddox, then they're going to need her there as well. And if they don't find him, then at least if they find what he's working on, then they'll need her expertise for that. Mm-hmm. But I do also like that they, you know, as you've kind of alluded to, they are just so different from each other. There is so much difference. They're all broken as well. They all seem to have something from their past that has really kind of caused issues. Because I mean, Picard is broken, Raffi is broken. You know, there's all something that they kind of need, and they're not Starfleet. They're kind of ex Starfleet for a few of them. But it's not like a typical, like, hey, we've just got a Starfleet crew on a Starfleet ship. It's not that at all.
Mm.
And that's a very unique kind of thing to what we normally see.
And they do sort of hint at it with Picard, like kind of reading the captain. He's like, yeah, I've been on this ship for 5 minutes and everything on this ragtag, quote unquote, vessel that you're running here, chum, is Starfleet regulation. Like everything is stowed and clean and up to snuff. Like there is not a hair out of place here, buddy. So don't try to convince me that you don't give a shit. This is a great conversation.
Did you notice the music as well on board that ship?
Do I notice the music? I remember a lot of music cues from this particular show. What I remember is the music from the last 5 seconds, not really the music when he was talking.
Because you get a bit of the TNG theme in the very last few seconds. You also get it the moment he beams aboard.
Oh, yes. No, I caught that.
So as he beams onto the ship, like it's his first time back on a ship in what would likely be a very long time.
And they do that.
And
they do that in another scene in another episode, either first or second episode, where he comes out of the transporter onto Starfleet campus, and they do the same sort of thing.
Yes.
It's either like it's the Captain Picard sort of theme for this particular show.
Yeah.
Or right now I'm associating it with space or the plot going in the direction of space. Whenever that happens, it does seem to have that kind of music vibe to it.
It's kind of him kind of grasping back at the things that are familiar to him, the things that he's lost from leaving Starfleet.
Mm-hmm.
So every time he's back onto a ship, he's back onto Starfleet headquarters, you know, anything like that, then you're kind of getting that little thing. And you kind of feel that yourself as well anyway. It's like, this is him back in his familiar territory. Mm. I love that. And I also love him being told to sit down.
Yeah.
And he goes instinctively to the captain's chair and he's like, not my ship. And then continues and sits at ops instead.
Yeah. And there's that moment too, and this is where the episode wraps up, where they're all ready to go, convinces, you know, the captain's like, can we get out of here already? And so Picard ushers the Doctor to her seat, you know, and then the captain, who is the captain of the ship, but he's been hired by Picard. So Picard is technically the boss, you know, and also because he's an ex-Starfleet dude, he knows who Picard is. Admiral, right? Yeah. Rank or no rank, like there's still that level of respect there. So it's just like, I'm not moving until you say so. Like it just, and yeah. you get that moment and, where you get to see Picard say, you know, engage, and the music pumps up and they go to warp and stuff. Like that was a fun moment, I think, for all involved. And I don't think for a moment that the actress Alison Pill that plays Jurati, I don't think she was necessarily acting in that moment.
I think that was genuine. Like I was actually thinking, like, if I was on set at that time, I would just be giddy. I'd just be like, okay, this smile, is it. I could die happy now.
Yeah, the smile on her face was just like, and I was here for that. You know, like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did have the line in one of the trailers, and I was worried that it was going to be done maybe a little bit cheesily, but it wasn't at all. Mm. There was nothing cheesy. Like, when they went to do all the reaction shots, I think it probably comes from what you're saying about Alison Pill, is that their responses are probably genuine, and it's the genuineness of that that stops it from being cheesy.
Yeah,
because normally you would have like forced reactions to something, you know, like when a catchphrase is kind of uttered.
Yeah, well, and I think what's the girl's name? His friend, Raffi.
Raffi.
I think Michelle Hurd. Yeah. Probably had the hardest job because she has to be there hearing this on set as an actor for the first time and knowing kind of like where she is and what kind of point in Star Trek history she's taking part in. But as a character, as Raffi, she's going to be there and be grumpy and not give a shit, right? And kind of like mask the whole like Patrick Stewart just said engage behind me. Like he just, you know, that just happened. But I have to be like, I have to be not care face. Like I have to hold this together. I don't know much about him. We only got to know him a little bit in episode 3, but I like the captain too. I enjoy.
Yes.
I think it's Santiago Cabrera.
Is his name? Who like I recognize him most from Heroes.
Oh, is that where he's from?
Because he, yeah, he was. What was his name? He was the guy who was the painter who had all the visions.
Oh, right. Okay, cool. It's been a little while since I've seen that show. So. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is he playing the holograms of the Doctor and the tech person that was on board too, or is that somebody else?
I had that same question. I'm pretty sure that he was.
Yeah,
I think it's just like the EMH is just basically has the same image as he is.
Yeah, because it just looks like him tidied up, right?
That's it. But because he's tidied up, it actually makes it a little bit hard to tell.
Yeah, it does. And plus, he's putting on all these crazy accents. Like the Doctor, I think, has got like just a straight American accent. But then the other hologram, the technical hologram emergency thing, has got like an Irish accent for some reason.
Yeah. It could very well be that it's an EMH program and he's just changed the default skin.
Yeah, could be. Could be.
You know, he's just gone to Minecraft.net and just uploaded it there. You know.
Yep.
That's effectively all that's happened. But one thing that I do, I keep saying, one thing that I love, there are many things that I love about this.
It's a good
one
show.
One additional
it
thing
is,
that
I mean, I can't stress enough how high quality, intense, but also fun, curious. Like, I mean, it's just a very good show.
It is the best written Star Trek show we've had since Deep Space Nine, in my humble opinion. I just think it's just so beautifully written. The people behind it know their stuff. And Sir Patrick, I mean, I've heard stories in interviews where there's been times when he stopped and said, no, we can't do it that way. The fans will notice. We have to do it this way.
Really?
And because he's been very... like everybody involved in the show wants to take so much care and things, and there's so many attention to detail. Like there's one scene in the first episode where right in the background there's an advertisement for Cassidy Yates' shipping company, and Cassidy Yates is Benjamin Sisko's wife from Deep Space Nine, and she was always kind of running freight. And so it's just like even a little nod that she's still running that business all these years later, which is really cool. But the way that they've written it as well, Akiva Goldsman did an interview with Will Wheaton, and he was saying how the first three episodes are really act one. You know, that that if you were to consider it like a pilot episode, the pilot is actually episodes 1 to 3. It's not just the first episode.
No, which and makes again, total this is sense. Yeah,
and it all comes back to this kind of long-form storytelling. And so he said that after episode 2 had aired, and after seeing episode 3 and where that ends, like that feels like if you were to take a Next Generation episode, this would be act 1. This would be where it ends, and the title sequence starts, and then you get into the rest of the episode. But in this case, an episode is an entire season. And they've done that with Discovery as well, that that each season of Discovery is really one story. And so traditionally it would be one episode, but it's just dragged on for several more hours.
Yeah, which I think for these kind of complex sci-fi stories, it can be a lot. Like, I think that the ongoing story arc in something like I'm blanking on it right now, not Outer Space, it's on Amazon.
Instead
of books,
The Expanse.
Expanse, thank you.
No,
you're right. No, The Expanse. I found The Expanse really hard to get into. I'm still struggling with even returning to it. I just find it very thick, and I think that it's difficult to throw yourself into something that new that's going so quickly into long storytelling, because in good ways, you know, again, I complain about being talked down to as a viewer. They don't do that in The Expanse. But I find that with stories like what they're trying to do with Picard, stories like what they do in things like Lost in Space, which I haven't finished, but I've got at least two or three done. There's enough going on that you need those 8 to 12 episodes to be able to digest it. Because if it all happened in a 45-minute show, like, my gosh, it would be impossible. It would just feel hokey. Like, it would just feel campy, which is, like, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about with the CW stuff, is that it just feels so forced when, you know, they have to cram everything in. And really, like, you know, with those old CW shows, or not old, the current ones, if you strip out all the unnecessary dialogue, you might have 20 minutes a show. Like, it's really, really black and white compared to the kind of writing that you're seeing in things like Titans in Picard, when they have the room to stretch and explore that kind of stuff. You know, you are more interested in seeing more about how the weight of what happened weighs on Picard over flashbacks, meeting up with Raffi, exploring that relationship, all that kind of stuff, than you would be if he just told you exactly why he was so grumpy in the first episode, right? Like, yeah. if he was talking to somebody and just kind of explained it all, you're just like, oh, now I know, you know?
They've also got the balance perfect for the three kind of viewers that you'll have. So there's people like me who obviously know a lot about the lore, the history, all the little details, like picking up Cassidy Yates and things like that. And then there's people like yourself who have seen Next Generation, remember bits of it, but don't necessarily remember details. And then there's going to be people who have never seen Star Trek before and are coming into this fresh. And I think that they've gotten the balance perfectly in for those who know and have lived with Star Trek for such a long time, like everything that they need is there. They can pick up on all the nuances. For people who aren't as familiar, like there's no details that are so crucial that you're kind of too lost about things. They're not explaining everything, which gives you that intrigue. But at the same time, the bits that they are explaining are just pertinent to the story. Mm-hmm. And then that helps people who aren't familiar with Star Trek, because you've got new characters who, yes, Picard has had quite, he's dealt a lot with Raffi. They have quite a rich history together. But this is not history that's been on screen before. This is new to everybody. So everybody is discovering these relationships and friendships and everything for the first time as well. Be it the people that, you know, the Romulans that that have been caring for Picard or Raffi and so on. And so it really does work well for that kind of balance, especially for a show which hasn't been on the air in, you know, 20 years.
Well, that wraps up this episode of the Citadel Cafe. You can find info about the stuff that Alistair and I talked about at thecitadelcafe.com. You can email the show like Dale and Lord Valor at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com. Find us by name on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe on iTunes, Android, Stitcher, Spotify, and soon YouTube. I am currently in the process of uploading some of the back catalog to YouTube. Not all of it, but a good chunk of it. So if YouTube is where you like to hang your podcast hat, as I know some of you do, then you should be able to find the Citadel Cafe there sometime in the next couple of weeks. Word of mouth, however, is the easiest way to support the show. If you like the Citadel Cafe, tell a friend about it and ask them to listen. It's just that simple. The more people that listen, the more support that we get. And I would very much appreciate you sharing the show around. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am doing online, including my illustration and design portfolio, at joelduggan.com. If you're interested in hiring me, just drop me a line through the website. You can also check out my other podcast, All About Minecraft, at thespawnchunks.com. We will have a lot to talk about on Monday, I'm sure, after we have had some time to play with the new snapshot. If you like to follow me on social media, then my name is easy to use. It's just Joel Duggan everywhere. And of course, I am on Twitch at twitch.tv/JoelDuggan, where I do a lot of video game stuff, but also a lot of live art. So check me out there. Alistair, I know that you're on Twitch. Where can people find you and watch what you're doing online?
On Twitch, I'm Alistair McFly, which is A-L-A-S-T-A-I-R. And obviously, I'm streaming a lot of Minecraft. I'm also have been streaming some Star Trek The Next Generation of Final Unity, and there's a few other Star Trek games that I will be streaming alongside Minecraft going forward. My website, as always, is omizod.com, where I have some writings on there. My Twitter is at imcfly, and I've actually just opened up my Instagram, which is ihoverboarder.
You've been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap to beam up.